And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast early on a Tuesday morning, where before we bring in the one and only Jeff Van Gundy to preview the 2019-2020 NBA season, which is actually happening, we would be remiss if we did not talk about the comments of LeBron James last night before the Lakers preseason game on the ongoing and very fraught China issue. And like everyone else, I was very curious about what all the players would say once they returned from China and to home soil, not the least of which was LeBron. Like many reporters, including Rachel Nichols and Dave McMenamin from our shop, I had heard details from the players' meeting, the Nets and the Lakers meeting with Adam Silver in China, where LeBron was probably the single most vocal presence in that meeting. And vocal doesn't mean good or bad, it just means vocal. So I was very curious to hear what he would say once he got back on home turf. And as the tweets were rolling in and the video was rolling in, I was stunned that the single takeaway from all of this, that after a week or 10 days of, I think it's been 11 days now since Daryl Morey tweeted his tweet about Hong Kong, that LeBron's single takeaway that he wanted to talk about was what appeared to be annoyance at Daryl Morey for tweeting. He called Daryl Morey misinformed. He said that Daryl Morey did not consider the ramifications of his tweet. And it was hard to know what exactly LeBron was talking about when he said ramifications. It was so hard to know what LeBron was talking about that he subsequently, I guess before the game in the locker room, tweeted two more times clarifying or trying to clarify what exactly he was talking about when he was talking about Daryl being misinformed about the ramifications of his tweet and not educated, not sufficiently educated to tweet about it. And when language is muddled like that, the natural thing to do as a reader and as a listener, one of the natural things to do is to wonder if the person saying the muddled language is trying to talk around a point, is trying to talk around something he does not want to say directly. And that, of course, led many observers from Nick Kristof to Tom Ziller at SB Nation to assume that LeBron was talking around the point about financial ramifications. I don't know that that was the case. In fact, LeBron's subsequent tweets seemed to hit on an endpoint of really all I was talking about was that Daryl did not consider what it would be like for those of us on the ground in China before he tweeted this. So if that's really all it is, just say that directly and leave it there, because the rest of it, the gobbledygook about ramifications financially, spiritually, emotionally, about Daryl being misinformed and uneducated, it gives certainly gives off the appearance that you are, if not concerned about the substance of his tweet, concerned about the ramifications, including the financial ramifications. And by the way, LeBron used the word financially. No one is putting words in his mouth. He said that word, that you are more concerned about that stuff than you are about whether it was okay for Daryl Morey to tweet what he did on a moral level and what he indicated and implied in that tweet about what was going on in Hong Kong. And that's a little bit disappointing. But maybe LeBron's comments last night really were just about concern for the players in China at the time that Daryl Morey tweeted. And maybe that's all it is. And if that's all it is, it's hard to argue with that. Now, it wouldn't be my single first takeaway after a week of that, but that seemed to be the endpoint. And that I empathize with. It's more than an inconvenience for those players. I can imagine that some of them were scared. I can imagine that some of them were scared about what is going to happen to me if I say one wrong, if we have media availability amid all this noise and I say one wrong thing, what is going to happen to me? I'm in a foreign country that I don't really know very well, or maybe I don't understand. LeBron, in subsequent comments to our Dave McMenamin, brings up, you know, what is a 19-year-old rookie supposed to do when a microphone gets thrust in his face? And by the way, the microphones are going to be thrust into everyone's face. I empathize with that. I'm not even, that's more than an inconvenience. I don't know if it's a hardship, but it's somewhere on the long continuum between an inconvenience and a hardship. And I wouldn't blame anybody there for being scared. And I'm not even talking about the money. And players lost money. Dave McMenamin is going to report today that a Lakers player lost a $1 million deal. Now, you can say that the money is the least significant of all of this, that we're all too obsessed with money. And I understand, like, I completely agree with that. The money is not the most important issue here. It's not even close when you're talking about what's going on. But you have to try to at least put yourself in a position of a player who would probably go over there and say, well, like, why us? why of all the millions of businesses that are making money in China, why does it have to be the NBA that is the first to sacrifice and lose money? Why do we have to be the flag bearers for this? Again, I'm not saying I agree with that. I'm not saying I'm sympathetic to it. I'm not saying it would be my number one reaction were I a player. I would hope actually that it would not be. But I try to be empathetic and I try to put myself in their shoes. And if I've lost $1 million poof out of my pocket, I might think to myself, why can't Apple or another company like that be the one that is the first flag bearer for this? It's not as trivial maybe as we would like it to be. That said, back to LeBron, I understand why people are disappointed that his first comments were saying you don't want to feud with Daryl Morey, but actually kind of maybe starting a feud with Daryl Morey. I thought I wanted to hear more reflections of, well, what happens now? This is what Woj and I talked about on our show last week. What happens now? We just go back to normal? Like, let's say what happens now is this. The Chinese government permits the broadcast of every NBA game that doesn't involve the Rockets. And maybe even they relent on that somewhere down the line. I don't know. Most ownership sources I've talked to in the NBA expect that to be the general narrative arc of this, that this sort of blows over. We have a return to normalcy, and that's it. Well, I want people to reflect on, well, that's not really it. This is not going away. The situation there has been laid bare in terms of what the response will be when someone crosses a line that the Chinese government does not appear to permit as crossable. The spotlight on the issues that Daryl Morey tweeted about is now louder than ever, both within the United States and within the NBA community. And the NBA is not a normal company. This is what many China experts I've talked to over the last 2 weeks have stressed to me. A normal company that does not have 30 very high-profile television products that are essentially subsidiaries of it can go to China, and you've read the list by now of all the companies that have done this, and apologize almost privately, and then there will be news stories about it in like the Wall Street Journal and some trade publications that the people who are very interested in that company's bottom line will read, and they'll become news stories, but not like this. The NBA is not a normal company. They can't just go back privately and find a solution with China without anybody hearing about it. Sports are different. The NBA is different. This issue is not going away. The issues that Daryl Morey's tweet raised, both about what's actually going on the ground there and what the government's response to it was and how it relates to the NBA, are not going away. And I was a little bit, I hope as more time goes by, we will get some reflection from the broader NBA community, including us, of like what this means going forward. This is what Woj and I talked about last week. Like, how do we reckon with this? This is not something that's going away. So I look forward to hearing from LeBron in the next couple of days. But I too, like a lot of other people, even if I am trying to be empathetic to what it must have been like on the ground there, I was a little surprised at his comments last night and their singular focus on Daryl Morey, and even the follow-ups. Even though his follow-up tweets ended on a very narrow and understandable ground of it was hard for us to be there and Daryl wasn't there. Like, I totally get that. I just didn't expect that to be the number one takeaway. It was both disappointing and surprising, frankly. That said, don't be this guy. Don't be the guy saying, oh, LeBron said Daryl is not educated enough, but look how many advanced degrees Daryl has compared to LeBron's degrees. Stop. Stop. I have a master's degree in U.S. history. You know how smart that makes me in regards to any of this stuff? Not smart at all. It means nothing. The degrees mean nothing. Do not be that guy. Do not jump off from here into a race for who has the most degrees and that somehow validates one person's opinion over another, because it does not. And do not jump from here to, you may be disappointed in LeBron's comments on China, it does not invalidate what he has done here, highlighting domestic political issues, opening a freaking school, and all of that. It is possible to hold these two thoughts at once, to be a little bit disappointed about what he said yesterday and very curious about what comes next, and still recognizing what LeBron has done domestically. You don't have to, one doesn't invalidate the other. With that, let's welcome in the one and only, the notorious JVG, to talk about the NBA season that is apparently happening soon. People! Hiring can be a slow process. Cafe Altura's COO Dylan Miskowitz needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company. It seems like a very important job, but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. You know what? He switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them proactively to apply for your job, so you get the best qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted the job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates applying. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. Easy, easy, easy. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. You almost literally can't get any faster than that. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. You can try it for free at this address, ZipRecruiter.com/lowpost, L-O-W-E, post the name of this podcast. That's ZipRecruiter.com/lowpost. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, let's bring on the one and only Jeff Van Gundy to preview the 2019-2020 NBA season, which is happening. Coach, how are you?
Doing very well, thank you.
We've done this podcast every year for the past X years, and it feels like every year it has kind of been us trying to talk around the fact that we all know the Warriors are winning the championship if they're healthy. This feels kind of exciting, right? Like, you must be reinvigorated a little bit. This is going to be, I think this year has a real air of mystery to it.
I think there's no doubt about that. I think there are a number of quality teams. Like, there always have been quality teams, but there's not one team that stands out like the Warriors when they were healthy. So I think it's going to be interesting. I'm not as sure that everybody, you know, I mock the optimism of all the teams at this point in the year. And then, you know, everybody's had the greatest summer of all and the greatest fall of all, and we're all together and we have all these pieces. So I love that the games come and people become separated throughout the year, like just how good certain teams are and how others either overestimated or overhyped what they had.
My favorite is that every overseas trip, which is obviously a little bit more loaded right now, becomes like, oh, it's a bonding activity. We're going to come back here. We're going to bond. I want one team to come back and be like, man, that overseas trip, like, it turns out that guy is super annoying, and that guy got drunk at the bar, and that guy, like, farted at practice, and it annoyed everybody, and, like, that guy has, like, it took him forever to order. When we went to the restaurant, he was asking the waiter, like, a lot of annoying questions about the nature of the poultry and the origin of the animal, and, like, I don't like it. I want one team to come back and be like, that trip just ruined us. That's what I want.
I like that, and I also like, if it was as easy as eating dinner together to build basketball chemistry, wouldn't everybody just go out to dinner? Like, I've never understood, like, this. It's not really on the court. It's getting to know each other off the court. That is such a crock of crap.
But it helps,
it's about
though, right?
How good you are.
But it can't hurt. I mean, I guess it can hurt if you get to know
yes,
each other.
Could.
And you,
yes,
yeah,
it could.
You
know. Like, if you're around, like you were saying, around a guy that you know, more and more. But it's not about hurting. It's about, we mystify the term chemistry so much. Like, you know, you have to go out and eat dinner together or, you know, go to the club together. No, you don't. Guys can play well together that barely interact off the floor. Like, this idea that you need to eat dinner and know that that guy over there has 4 brothers and 3 sisters, you know, I mean, that's ridiculous. And what other business do we say that we really need to know everybody to work well together?
I do think it helps. Like, we just had our ESPN.
I know you do, and I know so many people think that, and I am here to tell you some of the teams I've been around have had nothing to do with each other off the floor, right? And they play exceptionally well on the floor.
Well, look, I am going to continue to believe in the power of dinner and alcohol. Did you over the summer, did you put on any pounds of muscle? Did you lose weight? Did you work on your corner three? Are we going to see anything? Did you work on your suit game? Like, did you get a couple more fitted suits? Are we going to see anything? What are your off-season additions?
There were no additions because I was overseas in Australia, although and China. But I would say that one thing I did add to my game is, I understand why Brett Brown, for a period in his time, left and went to vacation in Australia and came back 15 years later, because it is that beautiful. It is incredible country. I mean, we were only there a week. I could have spent the next 3 years there. It was that nice. I was incredibly impressed with Australia.
I got to get over there. I've never been there. My wife has been all over the world. She says her favorite city she's ever been to is Sydney, and Melbourne might be number two. So I got to get over there. Okay, let's do, because this is an unusually, well, it's not even unusual. It just feels unusual because of the Warriors' dominance skewed everything about the NBA for the last 5 years. I wanted to do lightning round with Jeff Van Gundy. I got a lot of questions. I want to get your take on a lot of questions. Are you ready for lightning round question number one?
Sure.
Number one, who is the most legitimate championship contender? And I realize that's an amorphous concept because things are going to change between now and the start of the playoffs with trades and injuries and buyouts and all of that stuff. But just factor that in or don't factor it in. I don't care. In a universe in which everybody is relatively healthy, which of the following three teams is the most legitimate inner circle championship contender? The Denver Nuggets, the Houston Rockets, or the Utah Jazz?
I would say Houston on that. I like Houston's team. They took an overseas trip, so they're obviously got great chemistry. I like their team. I think they have a lot of questions, too. I think the idea, it's been sort of pontificated that there's been this huge upgrade, Westbrook over Chris Paul. I thought Chris Paul, other than his availability, I thought he played very well for Houston. Now, I think he played 58 games, so obviously he missed a ton of games. And 2 years ago, he wasn't healthy in the most important games of the year against Golden State. But I thought he did a good job here. And I think it was a more seamless fit between he and Harden than it is now between Harden and Westbrook. I'm fascinated to see how it works, but I really like Houston's team. I think they've been knocking on the door for quite a long time, and they have the ultimate home run hitter that no one has an answer for, particularly in the regular season, in Harden.
I went Utah, and Houston, I actually think people are a little bit underrating Houston because they're assuming it will not work between Russ and James. I think it'll work fine. I think they'll find ways to make it work. I bet Russ has a bounce back in his catch-and-shoot three-point percentage. I hope he does, because if he doesn't, they're really not going to be as good as they think. What makes me worried about Houston is depth. Now, you can say that doesn't matter in the playoffs because you only play your top six or seven guys, fine. I just feel, even before the last 10 days, there's just such an air of simmering like drama around. They just fired Mike D'Antoni's entire staff, save for two or three people. He's on an expiring contract. There were all sorts of rumblings about James and Chris not getting along and how that sort of forced their hand maybe a little bit in bringing in Russ, which, as you have said, has on-court chemistry issues. And now you throw in the owner and Daryl. It feels like there's a recipe there for it to go a little bit haywire that scares me a little bit. Now, here's what scares me a little bit about Utah and why I said Utah.
Can I say something about Houston first, though? And that,
absolutely.
You said about Mike D'Antoni. I'm interested. When a player comes into the last year of his contract, there's all this excitement because he's going to be a free agent and he's going to have a career year and he's going to maximize his opportunities. But when a coach comes into his last year, it's a negative term. It's like a lame duck. You know, at the first sign of problems, you know, are the players going to take advantage of him? Why don't we look at coaches coming into their last year as a chance to have a great year and build their market value? I think Mike D'Antoni, if somebody's going to come into his last year of his contract, he's got the perfect temperament to make it work the very, very best. I just love the way he's not distracted by anything. Now, I have no idea why they let go of so many staff members, particularly Jeff Bezdelic. To this day, I'm confounded.
They brought him in to save their defense in the middle of last season.
Yeah, I have no idea, you know, why that would be, because Mike was against it. So he's the guy that's dealing with him. What could Jeff Bezdelic have done to frustrate an ownership or a front office so much that they go against the wishes of the head coach? That one makes no sense. But I think Mike D'Antoni, to handle all of this, you know, noise that's been going around Houston, he's the perfect guy.
Now, to me, to use a Jeff Van Gundyism, to me, lame duck is not an indictment of the coach. Lame Duck is about what it does to the broader team chemistry when everyone on the team knows that this coach could be in jeopardy, might not be here for a long that's not different, I don't think, than a player in the last year of his contract or a player who everyone knows kind of has half a foot into the trade request territory. I think it's just less about – I think it's just more about broader uncertainty and what that does to chemistry than it is about anything that the coach has done wrong. I find similarities between the quote-unquote lame duck coach and the player on an expiring contract, or the player like in Anthony Davis's situation last year where everybody knew this is a simmering thing that's going to happen. But can I tell you about Utah first?
Yeah.
The reason I chose Utah is I think defensively and on the glass, they're still going to be very good as long as Gobert is healthy. And Conley at the top of it, it's like a catcher-center fielder combination. Their undoing in the playoffs has been an inability to hit threes, like almost a they've all been zapped by some sort of like zombie ray. An inability to have anyone who can create shots other than Mitchell, who was sort of overtaxed when he would get the ball with six on the shot clock every time and have to do something. To me, they've solved all of those issues. So I think they're going to be a very, very good two-way team. The one thing that I keep coming back to is the most important kind of player in the league is a big wing who can hurt you from the triple threat position, who can get the ball 18 feet from the rim, burrow his way in there, draw help, good passer, create open shots for teammates. The Los Angeles teams have three of those players between them in Kawhi, Paul George, and LeBron James, the best one of those players ever. It stands to reason then that one of the other two or three most important player types in the league is somebody who can guard those players, someone who can credibly defend those players without you having to have a jailbreak defense where everyone has to swarm that guy. The Clippers have two of those guys, and that's why they're so formidable. They have two guys that check both boxes. Utah, Royce O'Neal, maybe. Jeff Green, maybe. If you're playing those guys too many minutes, I think you're going to be in a little bit of trouble offensively. You can throw Bogdanovich in there because of the job he did on LeBron 2 years ago in the playoffs. I think LeBron slow-pedaled some of that series until the very end when he knew he had to post up every single time down the floor to get them through, and he destroyed them. And Bogdanovich is 2 years older. So that, I think, is a legitimate worry about the Jazz, and that is why hovering over the entire season is going to be what happens with Andre Iguodala, and are any other of those types of players going to be available via trade? And the answer is there just aren't that many who are A, good, B, on a contract that is not a complete disaster like Nick Batum's, and C, on a team that can say, yeah, okay, we're not in a position now where we need this guy to win. And one of the names I keep coming back to is Robert Covington. And so Iguodala, Covington, maybe a Jay Crowder would fall into that territory. Those guys, I think, have the potential to more than normal bump up some teams' championship odds by a non-trivial amount, or if the Lakers or Clippers get them and keep hogging those kinds of players, bump down the championship odds by maybe 0.5% or whatever it is of one of these teams. But that to me is the thing that worries me about Utah. It's also very interesting neither of us picked Denver. Are we underrating Denver?
Oh, Denver's outstanding. I think offensively they have a great player in Jokic and a bunch of really good players. I think what I'm interested with Denver is their continued improvement defensively. You know, do they have the same type of guy that you were saying who can go get his own shot on the wing position? And then I think secondarily for me, how do they manage their depth? They have a bunch of really good players. That doesn't mean you're going to have a bunch of really good, happy players. Because everybody is going to have to, with Porter coming in, with Grant coming in, how are they going to divvy up all the minutes? Because no matter how much depth you add, there's still only 240 minutes. And it's going to be interesting to me to see how those get divvied up and how they play from there. Because it's hard. It's really hard when you have depth to keep everyone in rhythm, happy and locked in.
I have this nagging feeling when I did my tiers power rankings column, I put Denver outside the inner circle. I have a nagging feeling I might be underrating them, although they face a little bit of the same issue of who's guarding the big wings. Now, maybe Torrey Craig, again, becomes a big playoff performer for them, but that makes me a little nervous. Maybe Michael Porter is the answer. That, for asking a rookie to do that, makes me very, very nervous. I kind of think they should give Malik Beasley at least a shot to start at the three. It doesn't appear that they're going that way, but I keep looking for reasons to not put Denver in the inner circle. Like exactly what we're talking about, their defense. What happens if Jokic gets into a playoff matchup that is, whether it's Houston or someone else, that is just bad for him? Now, Portland was a bad playoff matchup for him, but they almost survived that. They at least took it to seven. I don't know. I have a nagging feeling I'm underrating the Nuggets. What actually makes a better toothbrush? Is it industrial strength power? Claims of miraculous trendy ingredients, multiple modes? If you ask your dentist, they'll tell you it's less about the brush and more about how you use it. That's why Quip was created by dentists and product designers to focus on what actually matters for your oral health, healthier brushing habits. Quip's sensitive vibrations that have a built-in timer, they guide gentle brushing for the dentist recommended 2 minutes with 30-second pulses, ensuring an even clean, that tell you switch sides, switch sides. Quip automatically delivers brush heads to you every 3 months for clean new bristles right on schedule. That's important because you're not going to remember to do that on your own. The sleek, intuitive design is simple to use and comes with a travel cap that doubles as a mirror mount. Handy. These thoughtful features make brushing something you actually want to do twice every day. Imagine that. Good habits matter to live a healthier life, so help form fresh oral health habits with Quip. Quip starts at just $25, and you get your first refill pack free at getquip.com/low, my last name, the name of this podcast. That's getquip.com/low for your first refill pack free. getquip.com/low. Lightning round question number two with Jeff Van Gundy. Which Los Angeles team is better?
I think the Clippers have better talent overall right now, but I think the Lakers, you know, of the four stars that are on the two teams, two each, everyone has, like, such injury history, three of the four. James is the only one, minus last year, that you can count on to play a lot of games. So I'm going to say the Lakers right now in the regular season.
What about championship equity when we get to the end?
Again, you know, like, I know we're trying to say, assuming everyone's healthy, but we know how this league works now. It's like people sit out, people are hurt, people are reluctant to come back, and I think they're going to be even more reluctant to come back because of what happened with Durant and Thompson last year. So I'm going to still stay with the Lakers on that. I think the Clippers are, like, you know, obviously Leonard and George and Harrell and Beverly and all those guys, I think they're really good, but I'm going to stay with the Lakers.
I would say the Clippers, but it's close. Although, well, I think it's close, and I have the opposite feeling about the Clippers that I have about the Nuggets, where the second that I woke up at 2:45 in the morning and saw that they got Kawhi and Paul George, I kind of just said they're the favorites to win. These two, again, this type of player is the most important kind of player you have, and they just got two of the three best in the league, including the guy who has arguably ascended to the best player in the league status, and was just the finals MVP. And I do like their depth. I think they have real depth. All the guys you named, plus Lou Williams, plus Zubats, Jermichael Green, Rodney Magruder will help them, Landry Shamet. They have real guys on their team. I have a little bit of a nagging feeling that we all got caught up in the Clippers euphoria, and I still think they're the best team. I think they're the best team, period. I think they're the best postseason team if they're healthy right now, not including whatever happens with all the players that might get traded. I think the margin may be a little less than what I had initially thought. What's your biggest question about the Lakers? Everyone's been talking about how do they, you know, they're starting a traditional center. AD clearly doesn't want to play a lot of center. Who's their fifth starter? Is it Rondo? What does that do to their team? What does it do to Kuzma? Is he just a bench player? What's their closing lineup? Like, what's your take on their general kind of rotation issues? What of all of that is going to be your focus in the first couple weeks of the season?
I think for me, it's the defense. You know, I think I'm interested to see, you know, Anthony Davis, because you can forget just how good he is, you know, because you, because I didn't love how he worked his way out of New Orleans or how he went about it, but that's a different guy. You can forget how good this guy is. I mean, he is of all the guys that you named, you talked about Paul George, Kawhi Leonard, and you said they are arguably the best, you know, most important position. I could say Anthony Davis, when he's at his top peak health and locked in and really ready to go, he might be the most unguardable out of all of them, because you can finagle the matchups that you want. Like, you have Anthony Davis, and now let's say they're playing Denver. He plays center. Jokic has to try to cover him. That's a hard thing. I mean, his talents are such, his skills are such that Frank Vogel and his staff are going to be in charge a lot of matchups, who you want the other team to have on the floor, who you can get off the floor. I think he's that good. The guy is a great, great player.
I think he is the single biggest threat to Giannis repeating his MVP. It's amazing. I remember when I first wrote about Anthony Davis, I think it was at the end of his rookie year, he was having an incredible month. And I talked to the player development coaches in New Orleans who were working with him. And they talked about how the thing that's going to take us years maybe, is two dribble moves. And I remember thinking, wow, that's pretty basic. And they would say, watch the film. He's a one dribble guy. He can take one dribble and then he shoots. And because he can only take one dribble, it kind of limits his ability to read the floor and make passes and all of this. And then bit by bit by bit, almost so that you like didn't notice as it was happening in real time, last season he's averaging 4 assists a game. He's like busting out in and out dribbles and crossovers in the open floor and dusting dudes who should be able to handle that and dunking. And you would have these, and his post game has matured to the point that he can do a lot. He can play a power game. He can play a finesse game, righty, lefty, jump hooks, fakes, counters. His career high scoring average is 28 points a game. He's done it twice. Last year he got down to 26. I think he could average 30 this year. 4.5 assists, something like that. I think the Lakers are going to give him opportunities to create from the block one-on-one. I think Frank Vogel's going to let him bring the ball up the floor and go 1-4 flat for him. Just go to the basket. Beat your guy off the dribble. I think he's going to have an absolute monster season. And as you said, the one thing I didn't bring up in that whole soliloquy was defense. And I think you're right to pinpoint, for all of the focus on, now defense is interrelated to the rotation questions and all that, but for all the focus on fit and how are these stars going to fit, and this applies to every team that has 2 or 3 stars, I think defense is the thing that's overlooked. We didn't bring it up in Houston. I think that's the biggest question for Houston, is how good, what is their defensive ceiling? And I think you hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, I just think Davis defensively, and again, he's had these, you know, he just got, his thumb hurt the other day. You know, for whatever reason, the challenge for him is he's now in where he wants to be. You know, they made the trade. He got there. Now, the only thing that can get in his way is injury, and it has in the past. So, like, he is a dominant, dominant player. I think, could he be the MVP? Certainly. But even more so, he can be the best player on a championship team. I believe that. And then when you have a shared responsibility on that between James, who I think certainly is going to be excited about their opportunities this year, and Davis sharing that best player responsibility, I think they're a great playoff team.
I think I've said this before. I've said it all summer. It sounds weird to say. I think amid all of the snarky laughing at the Lakers, and they did fall ass backwards into all of this, and all the weird questions about their rotation that I outlined before, and just, you know, they're the Lakers. They're a circus. I mean, there's no other franchise where the president is resigning on national television without telling the owner, and then a couple weeks later he's going on ESPN and lighting the whole organization on fire. I mean, there was a lot to make fun of. Amid all of that, I think people lost sight of LeBron plus Anthony Davis plus some shooting equals trouble for everybody. Lightning round question number 3. if you agree that Milwaukee and Philadelphia are the two best teams in the East, and I don't know that you do, so I'll be curious to see if you accept my positing of that. Who is the third best team in the Eastern Conference?
Well, I'll say I think Milwaukee's the best team. I think with Philly, they've gone under such a transformation and supersized their team. So I'm interested in how they play, and I'm really interested in watching them play offensively as people start to game plan. I think they should be a dominant defensive team. So I'll give you your theory. I like Boston. Even though they had massive losses to their team, I also think they're going to gain some things. So I would say Boston would be my third best team.
Interesting. I have three candidates. Do you want to hear my three candidates?
Sure.
Boston, which I think is the consensus team. By Vegas, 538 has them pretty heavily in that spot, I think. Miami, I'm ludicrously high on Miami. I am traveling at ludicrous speed on the Miami Kool-Aid bandwagon. And Toronto. Apologies to Brooklyn. Apologies to Orlando. Sure, I guess. Any of these. Once you get past the top two in the East, if Boston takes an injury or Toronto starts a little slow, there ends up being almost no difference between, like, you can go 3-10 and any of these teams could be 3 and any of these teams could be 10. Like, that's how, and I'm including Chicago as 10. That's how sort of weird.
You make a good point about Toronto, though, in that last year, how well they played without Leonard in the regular season, that can't be overlooked. And I do think with him and Green gone, it opens up opportunities. So I can see why you would put Toronto in there.
So I think for me in projecting the season, the single most difficult – they're not the most difficult team to project because I'm confident Toronto is going to be pretty good. Not a contender, but not 39-43. I think they're going to be pretty good if they keep this team intact. What's difficult is I don't know how good they have to be to turn down the opportunity to trade Kyle Lowry, Marc Gasol, and Serge Ibaka for stuff that is going to help them recalibrate their team. That is one of the bigger variables hovering over the season, because Kyle Lowry could be the swing piece that turns a middling team into a really good team or a really good team into a great team. And I don't, Toronto has been very kind of cagey about their intentions. They just signed Lowry to that extension, which lasts only one more year and doesn't really affect his tradability one way or another, I don't think. That is the toughest variable for me to project. Let me give you an example. If you put Kyle Lowry in Miami for Goran Dragic's expiring contract, some filler money, and an asset, Miami with Kyle Lowry, Jimmy Butler, and the rest of that supporting cast is a dangerous team. I don't think they can win the East. I don't think they can win a second-round playoff series, but they're a dangerous team. Detroit, with Reggie Jackson plus Langston Galloway plus a first-round pick, with Kyle Lowry, Blake Griffin, and Andre Drummond, and by the way, they should run so far away from an Andre Drummond max contract, like flee the scene like the Roadrunner, becomes a dangerous team, a frisky team. And for Detroit, a frisky team is a win. Like that arena needs to be rocking in the second round of the playoffs. That's a win for them. But I just don't know where Toronto's head is at. And take Miami. So it has to be Goran Dragic, who, by the way, is not just an expiring contract. He's good. He's an important part of their team.
Exactly.
If healthy. Goran Dragic plus filler money plus an asset. Then you ask yourself, what's the asset? What's the asset? I don't think it's going to be Tyler Hero, who has destroyed the preseason. I don't think Toronto is going to care enough about the first available Miami Heat first-round pick, which could be 2025. They're going to say, Kyle Lowry is maybe the greatest player in the history of our franchise. We just agreed to pay him $31 million more when he's 35 years old or whatever it's going to be. That pick is not worth it for us. We didn't take a $30 million leap of faith for that pick at some point when maybe this entire front office, who knows? You never know what's going to happen in 5 years. And then I just keep coming back to Justice Winslow. And that is a really, really interesting. He is going to be the swing piece, I think, in a lot of trade talks for the Heat this year. And when you look at Justice Winslow and Kyle Lowry, the Heat have to ask themselves, as good as Kyle Lowry is, as well as he fits with Jimmy Butler, do we want to be in the business of trading 23-year-olds for 33-year-olds? That's it. Justice Winslow's good. He's weird. His position is weird. Is he a point guard? Is he a power forward? Is he both? Is his three-point shooting, which has been pretty damn good the last 2 years, is it real? Does it translate when people start guarding him more closely? He's a weird player, but I think the weirdness has shrouded that he's good and he's young and he can defend every position, and that is super, super valuable. And if Kyle Lowry ends up being not available, let's say that the Raptors start 20-10 and say, we're rolling it, victory lap, let's take it for the season. I don't know who is the piece that Miami is going to get with that kind of trade package that changes their team. So that's why Toronto holds a lot of the cards sorting out how if the league looks different in April than it is now. Toronto holds some of the most potent cards, because I agree with you. They're going to be good. That's a good team. It's not a great team, but it's a good team.
Yeah, I think they're good. I think Nick Nurse does a really good job. As an aside, I watched him work with the Canadian national team this year, and with all their defections and only having Kim Birch, he did as good a job as you could do with the national team that was that depleted of talent. So they have a tremendous head coach. They've got some prideful players, and I think if everyone was back, they would have been fighting, you know, the championship hangover. But because of the way it's worked out, I don't think they'll fight those same motivational issues. The thing you're talking about Lowry, he's still not playing, right? He's been off a long time. How ready is he to play to get off to a great start? I'm just interested in their readiness to go right from the start of the regular season. But I think they're a good team. And they may make changes, and they may decide to trade. And obviously, I'm not as big on Miami as you are, but, you know, Toronto's good.
I think Siakam is going to have a huge year and prove that last season was not only not a fluke, but that he has another level to hit, and I think he's going to hit it this year. Marcus Gasol's good. He's a good basketball player. Serge Ibaka's still pretty good. Fred VanVleet's good. They have a lot of, they have to fill 70 minutes on the wing every night. That is not easy. And they took some sort of buy low shots with Stanley Johnson and Rondae Hollis Jefferson that most buy low shots don't work out. That's why they're buy low. But that team's got some good players. And in the East, if you got some good players, it ain't that hard to win 45 games. People, do you ever feel like ticketing websites make getting to the event difficult on purpose? It's as if they're so big and so unwieldy they can get away with not caring about the customer experience, which should be the only thing they care about. But with millions of live event tickets and a price match guarantee, that's important. SeatGeek proves there's a better way. You can search for sports, live music, comedy, Broadway. SeatGeek has the tickets you're looking for all in one place. Your days of going to 17 secondary market websites are gone. SeatGeek pulls together millions of tickets from all over the web, and then it rates each deal on a scale of 1 to 10, and then it displays them on an interactive seat map that is so easy to read, even a moron like me can use it. Green dots mean good deals. Red dots means maybe overpriced. Every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. I have the SeatGeek app on my phone. It's the fastest, easiest way to find tickets. They've helped me get tickets before to even things like Hamilton on Broadway. And best of all, SeatGeek will give you $10 off your first purchase. That is a non-trivial percentage of like a baseball ticket or a football ticket, concert ticket. All you need to do is use the promo code that we're going to give you right now. Download the SeatGeek app today and use promo code LOWE, L-O-W-E, my last name, the name of this podcast. Bam, $10 off your first purchase. That's promo code LOW for $10 off your first purchase with SeatGeek. Lightning round question number 4, which you've already kind of gotten into, but I want to get into it more. Philly or Milwaukee, who's better? And you said Milwaukee in the regular season. Do you think that stands in the playoffs?
I think Milwaukee's really good. I do. I think they are, you know, they got beat last year. And Toronto, you know, certainly took that series, but I think Milwaukee will be better for their experiences last year. Giannis is obviously, you know, a great, great player. And I think what they continue to do, but I'll be interested in the Brogdon thing, losing him and how that all impacts their team. I just think very few NBA fans could pick out John Horst, right? I know when they hired him, I had no idea who this guy was or how good he was. He has done a tremendous job in making, you know, the Belichickian idea of we're not just collecting talent, we're building a team. He's brought it to fruition there. Their player acquisitions make sense. They fit around, you know, a great player. And I really like everything they've done. They're good at both ends. You know, certainly their defense was different in that in this day and age, I think Mike Budenholzer was so smart. Like, he took away the paint. Everybody is so reactionary to the three and every made three that they forget that the highest efficiency shots are layups. They did a great job of taking away the paint and not fouling.
I was going to say, and free throws.
And I just think I think they play good, sound, smart basketball with a highly talented team. They're my team to beat.
It's a good point about Horst. To get now, the Mirotić deal did not work out in the end last year. He crapped the bed a little bit in the playoffs and is now in Europe. But to go from not appearing to have that many trade assets to getting Nikola Mirotić on your team, who was a sought-after player by Philadelphia and other contenders, and then Brogdon, look, we can quibble about the Brogdon thing. I would have probably kept him. I would have bit the bullet and paid the tax. It's not my money. That's very easy for me to say. But they did get a first-round pick out of it and a second-round pick and a trade exception. So to recover that is good work. And I think it evinces a certain forward-thinking creativity that is in that front office that becomes very, very interesting this year, because no one in Milwaukee needs me to tell them they are now under enormous pressure. And maybe you as a coach could speak to this. I don't know if you ever went through this kind of transition. They have set the land speed record for quickest transition ever from like plucky feel good story to facing existential pressure to at least make the finals this year because of the Giannis situation. Until he says he's coming back, period. Like that last year, no, I was high on the Bucks last year and people thought I was a little crazy, but I wasn't that high. Like, I didn't think they would win 60 games and be the number one seed in the East. I thought they'd be a top two or three team in the East. And they were like out of nowhere, like, oh, Bud, first year coach in Milwaukee, and it's fun, and look at this, and they're playing this weird style, this innovative defense. And now it's like, then they lose, and they lose in the way that they did. Four straight games, Eric Bledsoe having a meltdown on national TV every night. Malcolm Brogdon goes away. Their margin for error thins out a little bit. They're under enormous pressure now. Like that, as someone who's lived in team environments, like I said, I'm not sure you ever went from feel good story to hunted that fast. Maybe you did it, I'm forgetting it. But like, that has to matter, right? Like the noise around that has to matter a little bit.
I was never a part of a feel good story, I don't think. You know what I mean? Like that. No, I don't. I don't. I just, you know, just for whatever reasons, the markets or whatever. So I think obviously the pressure they all feel is about Giannis and his return. But even if a guy says he's going to return, as we saw with Kyrie Irving last year, things change.
That's true.
And circumstances change. And so you can say one thing one day, and a few months later, things have changed. So I think he's different, though. I would be shocked, even if they lost in the first round this year, that he would leave. I think this is a guy who's tied to his organization and to his coach and to his teammates. I think he's different. I watched him with the Greek national team this summer. I think this guy is a guy who's all in, no matter what group he's with. But the group he's with, he's absolutely with. So I don't see his free agency being a huge factor on their team. I don't think he'll allow it to be. But I think the pressure of, you only have so many years and shots at it. I think that's what people, players and fans, they overestimate how often these opportunities come around. You can go from a real chance to no chance overnight. Be it age creeps up suddenly on important players, health diminishes on certain players, a trade gone wrong, another team, you know, elevating their game. So these are precarious situations, and they have a real chance to win it all. And I go back to Oklahoma City. Oklahoma City, when they went in the finals against Miami, I think they went up 1-0.
And almost,
no, they were down 0-1.
No, they went up 1-0 and came very close to going up 2-0.
Okay. And everybody was, after that game, oh, like, they're going to win multiple championships. This is a, you know, this is going to be, like, the next dynasty. And then things happen. And so for Milwaukee, it's their time to play well, learn from what went wrong last year, adapt their roster if they need to as the season goes along. But I think they're well-equipped. And I think they have, you know, the best chance to get to the finals. And then whoever you meet out of the West in the finals is going to be probably the favorite. But I like Milwaukee's chances to have home court in the finals, which gives you a legitimate shot.
What you just said, though, was my point about Horst and creativity. The pressure they are under this year. Now, maybe you're right, and they're just super-duper confident that Giannis is staying. They seem to be going into this with a lighter heart than – not a lighter heart like they're taking it lightly, but sort of a quieter – there seems to be less tension about it than there often is with players and teams in this situation. So maybe they know something we don't know. I don't know. But the creativity they showed last year suggests to me that if there's a hiccup, if they're a little bit disappointing, if they're not just going out there, because they should roll to the number one seed in the East, if there's something that's not right, they're a candidate to pull a big big may be the wrong word, a little bit splashy, a little bit interesting. They're a candidate to pull a rabbit out of a hat that people don't see coming, that is even maybe a little risky, because they can't afford, if their team isn't as good as they think it is on paper, if the reality turns out to be a little different, they can't afford to just ride that out into the playoffs. Again, unless they know something we don't know. My personal take, I think Milwaukee rolls to the number one seed in the East, but as things stand now, Philadelphia is not playing for the number one seed in the East. Philadelphia is playing to win a seven-game series against the Bucks. And, you know, I don't want to talk – I've talked too much about the Sixers already on previous podcasts and columns. I think they're equipped to give the Bucks hell in a seven-game series. Even if the offense looks clunky all year long, even if Ben Simmons still doesn't shoot, the single most important variable to me, maybe in the entire NBA – is if the Sixers can get Joel Embiid to peak in May and June and not January. If they can find a way to do that, whether it's load managing him, and he is not going to want that, whether it's more stringent regulation of whatever needs to be regulated about his diet or whatever, if he's peaking in May and June, they are going to be a giant, giant problem for everybody. And like I said, they're not playing to win 60. They might not win 55. They might struggle to win 50 if the offense is way clunkier than people think. And then they won't have home court. And as you said, that matters. People forget about that when we're projecting 6 months ahead. Game seven in Milwaukee matters. If they had snuck out game six in Toronto, they have an edge in game seven in Milwaukee, and they damn near snuck out game six in Toronto before the wheels fell off in the fourth quarter.
Toronto game seven over Philadelphia.
Yeah, there you go. But I think Philly is playing to win that playoff series. I think they're playing a long game, and I think they're equipped to win it. Okay, two more lightning round questions before I have to cede the studio to somebody else. We're not getting to all my lightning round questions. If you have Miami in the playoffs, and again, maybe you don't. If you have Miami in the playoffs, who is falling out from the top eight in the East last year? Because this is one of the – it's not rare, but usually there's one playoff team from the previous season that you can look at and say – well, they're out, and their replacement is obvious. Like in the West this year, it's the Lakers are replacing Oklahoma City. That's your very easy sort of flip-flop to make. In the East, all eight holdover playoff teams think they're a playoff team again this year, and the consensus is that Miami is a playoff team. So therefore, someone is falling out. Maybe you disagree on Miami. If you do, say that. If you don't, who's falling out?
Well, I don't think Miami's assured, no doubt. And give me the last four teams in the East. And by the way, I think New Orleans is making the playoffs in the West.
We're going to get
so
there.
You're going to have to take somebody else.
We're going
to
get there.
So give me the bottom four.
Last year, five through eight was Indiana, Brooklyn, Orlando, Detroit. So Brooklyn obviously made a lot of changes.
Well, I think all of those teams, you know, you could make the case because, you know, Indiana with Oladipo, but I think they're going to make it. I think Brooklyn will make it, although, you know, they went under their own changes. So I think the two that have, you know, obvious, they're vulnerable is Detroit and Orlando. I think Orlando, do they have enough shooting? How do the new pieces or the new piece of Fultz and then Aminu, you know, Bamba back, how much better, if he is better? Plus, I think they're going to – do they have enough offense? That would be there, because I think they're going to be an elite defensive team. And then Detroit, you know, health of Griffin, Jackson's play, starting two guard, how much can Kennard continue to improve? You know, those questions are certainly there. But Blake Griffin is so good. If he's healthy, I think he'll carry them back to the playoffs himself. He's that good.
So they're all making the playoffs, or are you picking Orlando?
No. I'm saying I think the two most vulnerable teams. I'm not saying Miami's in.
Okay.
I'm saying that I think the two most vulnerable teams, if they were to make it, are Orlando and Detroit. I think Brooklyn and Indiana will find their way back to the playoffs. I'm not saying that I believe Miami is a sure thing like you are.
Well, I mean, look, none of these teams are sure things, but if the Heat stay healthy...
Or you know what I mean. I don't have them as... I think they're in that same mix. They're vulnerable. They're, you know, they're going to be in that high 30 to mid 40, and so many things can impact and factor into that. You know, they have some weird situations going on. James Johnson's situation. Now Waiters has been away, you know, like... So chemistry and continuity... Are they going to start Hero, or are they going to bring Dragic off the bench? I'm interested in watching all of this. You know, the Winslow development that you talked about earlier is interesting. Can Myers Leonard, can he play every night in a rotation? Is Bam Adebayo a four or a five? Can he and Olynyk play? Well, you know, like all those questions.
Tons of questions. There's no.
Yeah.
There's
and
no.
So I'm interested in them. Yeah.
They're the weirdest team in the league. There's no question that they face a lot of questions.
Yeah, but I'll say this, and you know, I know I praise like all coaches, but I think we have forgotten just how good, because their roster's been in flux. We've forgotten how good Eric Spoelstra is. He's a Hall of Fame coach. I mean, this guy. At the end of the day, is going to be in the Hall of Fame. He's that good. And he's won big. He's won championships. He's gone through rebuilding. He can mix and match. I think the guy is a spectacular coach. And for someone to last in a spot in the NBA now, as long as he's lasted, incredible. Incredible longevity. And I think he's going to be there. Quite honestly, he might even break Pop's record as far as how long he stays in one place.
It's going to be up to him. The answer is going to be up to him. And I think Eric Spoelstra and everyone with the Heat has been reinvigorated by having a top 15 player on their team. I just think when LeBron left...
What did you say, top 15?
Yeah.
You said top 15?
Yeah. Okay. You think Jimmy's below that?
I don't know. I haven't counted it out. I think he's very good. I'm going to be interested in the every night ability. I think in Minnesota, his first year, he was fantastic.
I think we're getting that guy. If he's healthy, I think we're getting that guy.
Well, if he does that, then he's, you know, then they're in. They'll be in the playoffs because that year, he was spectacular. Spectacular.
My pick, because I'm putting you on the spot, my pick for this question, I think Detroit is quote-unquote the right pick. I think that's the safe pick. Because if Blake misses 20 games, and he has often missed 20 games, I think they're in all sorts of trouble. But the safe pick is boring. I'm really worried about the Pacers, and I feel like I'm out on an island being worried about the Pacers. I don't know why it's assumed that Oladipo is going to come back and look like second team All-NBA, or I don't know if he made second or third. I know I voted him second. Victor Oladipo from two seasons ago. People are underestimating the loss of all the of their two starting forwards, Thad Young and Bojan Bogdanović, and what that does to them on both sides of their ball, how it chips away at their identity. And you can tell me, oh no, they've replaced those players with TJ Warren, who can swing between the three and the four. Sabonis is going to start at the four. They're going to start Sabonis and Turner. Like, those are quality players. I agree. They stole TJ Warren from Phoenix. Sabonis is a monster. I don't know that it's just plug and play, though. Like, we haven't seen TJ Warren play a meaningful NBA game ever. We have not seen him play a meaningful defensive possession ever.
That's a good point. And I also think those two forwards that you had, that you mentioned for Indiana, you know, those are significant losses. Sabonis, you know, it remains to be seen how many minutes Sabonis and Miles Turner can play and play effectively together. And they're both very, very good players, but they've got to make that pairing work if they're going to do it as starters for major minutes against, you know, different type of units. And Sabonis doesn't have a real scorer's mentality. He's not going to go down there time and again and try to punish smaller fours in the post. He's a great ball mover. He's an adequate, you know, mid-range shooter. I think he's good in the post. He's just a solid all-around NBA player. T.J. Warren, you don't know exactly what you're going to get. And Oladipo coming back off injury, how quickly he can regain form, like you said, is a question mark. I think with Brogdon, I like their team. I like how they play. I think Nate McMillan, you know, organizes a very, very sound team and one that's not going to beat themselves. So I think they have a great opportunity to get back to the playoffs. But again, there are no sure things.
Last lightning round question before we let you go, and you've already hinted at it. Lakers are going to replace Oklahoma City in the playoffs, or the Lakers are making the playoffs, whatever it is. And if you think another team is vaulting from not in the playoffs to in the playoffs, is it Sacramento, New Orleans, Dallas, or team TBD that's outside of that group? Maybe you love Minnesota. Maybe you think Oklahoma City is going to keep it together and become a 45-win team. If someone is butting in, you've already said, is it only New Orleans, or are multiple of those teams going to make the playoffs?
Of those teams, New Orleans, to me, I think they're going to make the playoffs. I think...
Yes! I love it.
I mentioned this to you off air. I think Zion Williamson saved pro basketball in New Orleans. It was a very tepid fan base, and now I think you're going to see a fan base that comes out and gives a team a real energy. I think their enthusiasm as a group to come back off last year's, like, sort of a downer, malaise type of attitude, I think is going to be great. I think they're going to score. My question for them is, you know, can they guard well enough when it gets to a grind of the long, you know, regular season, and can they maintain their energy and enthusiasm? But I think they're going to make the playoffs. And I think I saw firsthand how great Greg Popovich was this summer, you know, with the World Cup team, and how he is so incredible with players and, you know, so to bet against his team. But I think they're good. I don't think they should have won. I think they won 48 last year. How they did that, I have no idea how he managed that. And I know they have some guys back and they have some changes, but I just think at the end of the day, New Orleans has more better players, and I think they're going to find their way back into. I think they're going to find their way into the playoffs.
I've been leaning toward Dallas. I agree with you that San Antonio is the most vulnerable. Golden State is hard to project, but I have them in. People will make the argument about Portland. I think Portland actually is vulnerable, but I also think Portland is going to make 1 to 2 win now trades if they do prove to be vulnerable. That sort of bolster their team. So I think it does come.
I think Portland's very vulnerable. I think they're starting forwards as up and down as they were. They had an identity, and now I'm like, that front court is all in flux. Is Nurkic coming back? How well? How soon? You know, the Whiteside factor, and then the starting forwards. I'm concerned.
I think you should be. I think Portland is not a lock, and to classify them as a lock, I think, is a little overzealous in the West. It is hard to bet against Damian Lillard, who seems to never miss games, and the infrastructure they have there. And again, I do think they will go all in to make a run this year, whatever form that takes. I've been leaning towards Dallas as the interloper, but I've had, between watching New Orleans last couple preseason games, and my God, it's hard. You got to not overreact to preseason, but sometimes Boston showed us last preseason that they revealed legitimate problems in preseason. Sometimes stuff that happens in preseason matters. And one of the things that has happened in preseason is that Zion looks really, really good. And I had a GM tell me yesterday, Zach, if Zion is one of the, if he walks in the door as one of the 20 best players in the NBA, we all, not you, Zach Lowe, not you, ESPN, we, all of us, need to reconfigure our playoff odds right now. Because if he's that good, all the fit issues and the lack of shooting and the rotation and this and that, this is what he said. Good players, you throw out the complexities. Great players, f*** up your defense. That's what they do. And if he's a great player, if he's not a good rookie, if he's a great player, you need to reconfigure your playoff predictions. And maybe that's where we are. Maybe that's where we are. Any final thoughts? Because I got to give up the studio in about 1 minute.
No, I'm very interested in all of these questions. I think it's going to be an interesting year with a lot of roster changes still to come. And that, I think, at the end of the day, will give us a better picture of who's going to meet in the finals come June.
Coach, I love this annual preseason exercise. Let's do it again soon. I really look forward to hearing you on the broadcast, as always. Best to you and your family. Jeff Van Gundy, everybody.
Take care.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.